the last 2 weeks. They were talking about, you know, hitting the oil resources in Iran. They were talking about the nuclear facilities. They were talking about, you know, really to hit hard on the Islamic Republic. But they didn't. They didn't because they know now the retaliation is ready. And Iran this time is not going to send only 200 rockets as they did last time. And it was all accurate, and it was all, you know, inflicted a huge damage in Israel. They know that this time the Iranians were preparing between 800 to 1,000 rockets to go once at a time. So because of that, I think they tried to keep it in a very low profile.
All right, let's turn to Houston. Welcome Mohsen Naqvi, activist and commentator. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in a meeting on Sunday with the families of the martyrs, reiterated the importance of security as a foundational pillar in all aspects of society and everyday life. He said that only a strong Iran can ensure and guarantee the security and progress of the country and its people. Your thoughts and overall assessment of what he said, and do you think that Iran has portrayed an image of strength during this latest attack by the Israeli regime?
I think as Imam Khamenei said, that this attack should neither be exaggerated nor should it be downplayed. I think that's the exact narrative that should be taken and understood, that the fact that they were able to do this, but they weren't able to cause any kind of material damage. The reason why it's come, why Iran has come, has shown its strength, is because Iran's defense capabilities were also seen against the Zionist regime, which hadn't been as such witnessed before. There were many criticisms against the Islamic Republic's ability to be able to defend itself. So we had seen the Islamic Republic attack multiple times. We have seen the Islamic Republic help manufacture and arm its allies in the axis of resistance. But there was talk that the defense capabilities of the Axis and the Islamic Republic of Iran are weak, but clearly they're not. We saw how people were driving by the so-called area that was targeted by the Zionist regime to show that everything is fine in the Islamic Republic. Nothing has changed. That this attack, yes, it was an attack. The fact that they were able to even think of attacking the Islamic Republic of Iran in this manner, a direct attack, is something to be prepared for. But the fact that Rehber is saying that it is important for the nation to increase its ability to defend itself, that very statement in itself is a sign where the general narrative and the general move is towards, that Iran has to be able to defend itself, and it has been defending itself for many years. But definitely, in this entire conflict, and specifically the recent escalation by the Zionist regime, there is absolutely no doubt that the Islamic Republic has come out strong, and they have proven to be very much able and capable to defend themselves. And there are still many more surprises to come by the Axis and by the Islamic Republic of Iran, as has been mentioned by their military leadership.
Okay, well, Saad, would you label this attack on Iran as a U.S.-Israeli attack due to the fact that the U.S. actually controls Iraqi airspace and is Washington, which allowed the Israelis to launch the attack from Iraq?
Yes, nobody can deny that the Americans are totally involved. They said that we were informed about the where the head is going to be and the timing and everything. But not only that, I think that they are involved in so many ways because the distance is very, very long distance, and they need definitely more of technological assistance in such a raid on the Islamic Republic. So the Americans were there all the way, whether it's from Iraq, where they also maybe they landed in some of their bases in Iraq to be refueled and then continue, or in their way back. So the Americans are involved. Plus, The Americans said that we are preparing to defend Israel in case the Islamic Republic is going to retaliate. And they provided the Israelis with the THAAD anti-rocket facilities, as well as now they are going to add another unit to this with American soldiers on the Israeli state to defend the Israeli bases. So they are in fact involved in this matter. But at the same time, they don't want to appear that they are involved, and they don't want to try to pressurize the Israeli not to go further. And they don't want the Iranian to retaliate also in a very harsh way, which would make the retaliation and re-retaliation is an ongoing issue, which might bring the whole area into a regional war. So I think now they are employing lots of diplomatic kind of activities here and there in order to calm down the situation and to have tried to make the Iranian retaliation, at least if there is a retaliation, to be on its minimal level in order to keep the whole area from that. At the same time, they are implying that there might be resuming of the talks for the ceasefire in Gaza and in Lebanon. And by the end of the day, that's what we want. Everyone wanted that, because if they stop the war now, it means that Israel never won this war. And to the contrary, it's declaring that they are, not only their failure, but also their defeat in this war, whether it's on the Lebanese front or in Gaza front, because they didn't achieve any of their goals in both areas. So by that, if they are really genuinely are going and the American pressurizing them to go for ceasefire negotiations, that will be also for the best of everyone, because that will be a clear declaration of the defeat of Israel.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Mohsen, he talked about the ceasefire. And we know what Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian has said regarding what has just happened. He said, for sure, Iran would retaliate, one. And two, he said, because prior to this, after the first attack, whatever, and he said that the United States had actually lied to them, had promised them that they were going for a ceasefire. I mean, can anyone count on the U.S.'s word about a ceasefire or going for a ceasefire? I mean, your thoughts on this?
Well, clearly, history has taught us that the U.S. empire can never be trusted. They have always broken their promises. In terms of the experience that the Islamic Republic of Iran under Hassan Rouhani and under Mohammad Zarif has been that there was an effort by the previous governments to have negotiations with the U.S. But they failed because they keep lying. They keep breaking their promises. And to really even expect anything positive from the U.S. empire in terms of them committing to enforce a ceasefire and encouraging the Zionist regime to have a ceasefire, I think in my humble opinion, it seems very far-fetched, and it doesn't seem to be the right kind of policy to have any trust in the U.S. empire, especially if we observe the teachings of Imam Khamenei. Even not once ever since 1979 have we seen either Imam Khomeini or Imam Khamenei showing any kind of faith in the U.S. empire's commitment for any kind of truce or in this current conflict, even a ceasefire. So developing a policy around these fake promises will never work. But it's also a lesson that one has to go through. Also, I also understand that there are strategic reasons that the war front is open on the end of the Palestinian. And as Sayyid Nasrullah, before his martyrdom, had always mentioned that their attacks on the northern front will not stop till there is a cease, till the attacks on Gaza don't stop, or till the Palestinians don't say that there should be a ceasefire. So, but this is now a new escalation. This has become an open war. And as all the leaderships, including the Supreme Leader, Imam Khamenei, has also mentioned, that there will be a retaliation. There has to be a retaliation. There have been martyrdoms from this attack. So it's important that we don't, as Weber said, that we don't downplay this move, but also we don't exaggerate it. We take it for what it is. And clearly the Islamic Republic has the damages that the Islamic Republic has done on the existence of the U.S. empire in the region of West Asia and the Zionist regime. They can't be undermined. These are scenes that have never been seen before in West Asia. The Islamic Republic has come out to be a power to be reckoned with, and the axes of resistance are the ones who are calling the shots now. The U.S. empire and the Zionists are this vulnerable in this region.
Okay. Well, Saad, the leader of the revolution has also said that Israel miscalculated Iran's power and determination, and we need to make them understand this. And also, my question to you would be, do you think that the collective West in general, along with the Israeli regime, has miscalculated Iran's abilities, or your assessment?
I think that, yes, not only they miscalculated and they misreading as well, and especially because of that, the illusions that the Israelis are trying, you know, to give the whole world, to say that Israel is the superior in the area and they can do whatever they want. But they are forgetting the new realities that after the 7th of October, which was created, now Israel is not the supreme power in the region. There are other powers, and it's even more than Israel. And Israel tried in the last year and month now almost without achieving anything. So they are trying to restore their strength in a way or other, or to restore their reputation as the superior army in the region. But definitely when they tried to do that with Iran, this is a new reality. Now Iran and the axle of resistance in the region is a new reality after the 7th of October, especially with the axle. We are talking about Lebanon, Palestine, Yemen, and Iraq are all, and Syria are all together in one front, and this is an unprecedented issue for the very first time. And Israel had to realize these changes in the region. This is the showing of the power of Iran in the region, and Iran is, whether Israel like it or did not like it, it's a major player in the region, and they have to take into consideration these kind of changes. But apparently that the Israelis and the Americans are still thinking of their own plans for the region, to create this new alliances from some Arab Gulf states, countries with Israel under the leadership of Israel. And this alliance is supposed to be, you know, to defend the area from the Iranian influence, which is absolutely now is something, you know, you can't think of, because this Israel can't do that. Nor now, I think also Arab countries who were willing to ally with Israel, to be, mm-hmm. you know, in an alliance, I realized that what the capability of Iran and the capability also of the axle of resistance, okay. And they tried Israel in this war.
Okay. Well, Mohsen, the Israeli regime says that for now it's not interested in any further escalation with Iran. However, Iran's president, Mr. Pezeshkian, has said that Iran will definitely respond to the attack. I mean, your thoughts about that?
I mean, they can say that they don't want to escalate, but this retaliation in itself is an escalation. They can say what they want, but for the axis of resistance and for the Islamic Republic to maintain the status quo and to ensure that the deterrence of their power is maintained in this region, it will be important for the Islamic Republic of Iran to retaliate. And also, if the Islamic Republic doesn't retaliate, and the Islamic Republic takes its time for its retaliation, as we saw in Operation True Promise 1, as we saw in Operation True Promise 2, there will be another surprise. It's almost like a chessboard that the Axis of Resistance and the Islamic Republic have been playing with the U.S. Empire and the Zionist regime from day one. No one expected the new ballistic missiles that Hezbollah launched after Sayyid Nasrullah's martyrdom. The Israelis miscalculated every single move that they have made. They weren't expecting Operation True Promise 1 or Operation True Promise 2. They weren't expecting that after these two serious escalations by the Islamic Republic, the U.S. Empire won't directly militarily involve itself, because the actions of the Axis and the Islamic Republic are within international law. It's within the realms of the rules of engagement. So it doesn't give that leeway to the U.S. Empire to involve themselves directly, because it's also important to understand that the West and the Empire, they have to maintain a certain persona of so-called justice and use the Zionist regime as a mask for their own atrocities. So it's really important to understand that to maintain this deterrence and the status quo, that there is a new power in West Asia, and that power is here to stay. And as a matter of principle, the Islamic Republic, as the president has said, and as Weber has also implied, that there will be a retaliation. There is absolutely no doubt in that. And as I had also previously mentioned, that the words of the Zionist and the words of the empire, of the U.S. empire, they have no weight. They have never, ever acknowledged any of their commitments in the past. So why trust them now? There is no reason to believe the words that come out of the Zionist regime. The Islamic Republic and the Axis, they have their own strategy, they have their own principles, and they operate from what their own beliefs and strategies are, not from mere statements that are given by bigots like Netanyahu or Ben-Gavir or Gallants, for instance. So,
okay. Well, last question, Professor Nim. Where do you see this going? I mean, do you see the situation escalating between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Israeli regime?
No, I think now that it depends on Israel. Now I think the Israeli came to realization that they couldn't achieve anything. And I think now the internal pressure started to grow up in Israel against Netanyahu and his government regarding this war, whether it's in Gaza or in Lebanon. And now he's tried to find a kind of a solution, or try to find, a kind of a solution to bring him down from the tree. And I think that the Americans are also willing to do so now, because it proved that the Israeli can't do much better than what they are doing. And now they are losing. To the contrary, we are talking about a huge amount of soldiers in the Israeli army who are expressing that they don't want to fight in Lebanon, they don't want to fight in Gaza. The situation is really, really very bad. Hezbollah is doing very well, and they have a lie about after the killing of some of the leaders of Hezbollah, and especially the Secretary General, Samahat Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and they thought that this will end Hezbollah. And it apparently, it appears to them that it was a big lie, that Netanyahu could use it internally in Israel to see this is a big achievement. But in reality, that does not change Hezbollah. And to the contrary, every day there is you know, casualties among the Israeli, and heavy casualties. And they couldn't even enter the Lebanese soil to more than like few hundred meters, and that's it. So apparently they are losing bad time there, and the Israeli public as well is noticing that. The same is happening now in Gaza. After, you know, we are talking about Jabalia, that's for the fourth time. Now they are reoccupying Jabalia, and yet the resistance there is you know, giving them really, you know, hell, if you like. So because of that, now the Israeli, I think they are trying to find some kind of solution in a way or another, but they want to appear as victorious anyway, but that is not going to happen.
All right, and on that note, thank you both for being with me, Mohsen Naqvi, activist and commentator out of Houston, and Saad Nem, professor of political science, Beerzad University out of Ramallah. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time. Goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, be careful who you love when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. We are talking about how you should be careful who you love when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Now, first and foremost, in a previous program, we talked about it, but because we are once again talking about love, it is important for us to make a very quick differentiation between the love which is promoted in the Western world and the hedonistic culture of the West as compared to love in the Islamic culture. So when it comes to love in the hedonistic or capitalist or a slave-inducing culture of the West, love is always connected with and interrelated with sexuality in its various different forms. Love equals sexuality in the West, when in the Islamic formula and in the Islamic lifestyle, love is not necessarily connected with sexuality. Rather, love is this very pure attraction that one has first and foremost for the Almighty Allah, and then, of course, the infallible and immaculate, the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Quran, our family members, our parents, our wives, our children. These are two very different understandings of love. And when we look at love as far as the Western world is concerned, we will find that in one way or the other, they make use of, take advantage of, and they earn an income based upon connecting this aspect of love with sexuality. So coming back to the Islamic lifestyle, when we're talking about love, it is this pure and this very untainted feeling and emotion that, as we said, first and foremost, is connected with the Almighty Allah. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we had started talking about how we should be very careful who we love when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. And now you understand why we had to make this differentiation and this bifurcation between these two concepts of love. Otherwise, we'll be confused. Now, we find that in the traditions of the infallible and immaculate Imams, alayhimus salam, especially Imam Ali, alayhi salam, His Eminence says that one should be incredibly careful and beware of loving the enemies of Allah. Now, of course, we're talking about that being close to the enemies of Allah, being near to the enemies of Allah, loving the enemies of Allah, admiring the enemies of Allah. And then he says, even harboring affection, which is a level lower than love, even harboring affection for those people that are other than the friends of Allah, beware of doing this, because indeed a human being will be resurrected with those whom he loves. So incredibly powerful, as we are quickly running out of time on the program. So we have to, as a part of our Islamic lifestyle, we have to be very careful. And really, when it comes down to it, do not love the enemies of Allah. Do not admire the enemies of Allah. Do not even harbor affection for the enemies of Allah. Because if you or I or me are a friend of Allah, then, you know, we are, you know, the friend of my enemy is my enemy type idea. So if they are the enemies of Allah and we are the friends of Allah, then they are going to be our enemies as well. Whether they say so or they don't, it doesn't matter. The equation stands strong. And so if they are our enemies, whether they say it or not, and we end up loving them, then we very clearly know who is at loss. So please be very careful of who you love in our Islamic lifestyle. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As in previous years, people from Pakistan and Kashmir took to the streets on October 27 to mark Black Day. Pakistan regards this day as the anniversary of India's defiance of British partition plan in 1947, which led to India's control over the Jammu and Kashmir regions. The day was marked with rallies, protests, and seminars to express solidarity with the Kashmiri people and their continued struggle for self-determination under Indian control.
We will continue to raise voice for the oppressed people of Kashmir who are facing atrocities by Indian forces in Jammu and Kashmir regions. We want justice from the international community for their right of self-determination.
We condemn Indian illegal occupation of Jammu and Kashmir region. Kashmiris have been struggling for their right to self-determination for the past 77 years. Thousands of Kashmiris, men, women, and children have been brutally killed by Indian occupied forces in recent years, and the international community is just a silent observer.
Kashmir, a predominantly Muslim Himalayan region, remains a point of division between India and Pakistan, both holding parts of it but claiming the region in full. The Kashmir conflict has led to several wars between the nuclear-armed neighbors since their separation in 1947. The observance of Kashmir Solidarity Day allows not only the people of Pakistan, but also its government to voice their support for the Kashmir Liberation Movement.
Pakistan will continue to extend political, diplomatic, and moral support to our Kashmiri brothers and sisters for the just and peaceful settlement of the Jammu and Kashmir dispute in accordance with the UN Security Council resolutions.
Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari and the Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif urged the international community to push India to end human rights abuses in Jammu and Kashmir regions and to implement UN Security Council resolutions.
In the face of global diplomatic pressure, Pakistan's stance remains unwavering as it advocates for a resolution that aligns with the Kashmiri people's aspirations and their right to self-determination. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
The multinational financial institution Barclays was forced to close its doors in Belfast on Saturday due to a Palestinian rights protest. The bank has supported arms suppliers to Israel to the tune of more than £8 billion since 2021 alone.
We want them to understand that it's wrong. We want them to understand that they don't have to profit off war and death and destruction. We don't have to profit off dead people. We don't have to profit on bombs being dropped on kids, on hospitals and schools.
Activists are convinced that Washington is responsible for the Middle East crisis.
Obviously, the United States are driving it. Look at the size of Israel. It's a tiny country. It isn't even a country, it's just on somebody else's land. It's tiny, absolutely tiny. And look at the control they have, look at the power they have, look at the weapons they have.
Barclays, you can divest from. You have like McDonald's who are they're actually giving free meals and things to the IDF, and it's just appalling. And, you know, I personally don't want my money to be used in that sort of way.
Despite public outcry across the globe, the Israeli regime's indiscriminate killing of innocent civilians in Gaza, the occupied West Bank and Lebanon shows no sign of abating.
It's typical Western foreign policy, really, trying to control the world through proxies. And I think Israel is a proxy that's gone rogue and it's out of control.
They'll say, you have to stop doing this. Now here are the bombs to do it with.
So you think the United States is talking out of both sides of its mouth?
Yes, absolutely. And it has been for generations.
The campaign to encourage customers to close their Barclays accounts was launched in July 2022. And since then, almost 4,000 people have done so. That effort is ongoing. It is easy to switch banks in the UK. And these campaigners want as many people as possible to close their Barclays accounts on the same day to ensure the greatest possible impact. And that day is Thursday, November the 21st. Jerome Hughes, Belfast.
The Husseiniyah of Imam Khomeini is filled with people who are here to meet Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The families are holding up pictures of their martyred loved ones. These are families that have lost a loved one for Iran's security.
This is one of the routine meetings that the leader holds with members of the public. And this time it is with families of martyrs who gave their lives to protect Iran. For those in attendance, a rare honor. Their presence, a strong act of support. Their chants, a powerful pledge of allegiance.
This is the first time I have the privilege of meeting the leader, and I am filled with excitement.
I have had the distinct honor of meeting the leader on four or five separate occasions.
With all my heart, I am immensely proud of my martyred husband for his sacrifice.
We are immensely grateful to all our youth from diverse backgrounds and varying perspectives for their unwavering support of the leader. Their love and honor for the martyrs are a testament to their devotion.
If the leader calls for war, I am ready to make the ultimate sacrifice, just as my husband did.
If the leader calls for war, I will be the first to answer the call.
Our loyalty to the leader and the Islamic Republic is unwavering. We believe this will help ensure that Iran remains strong and resilient.
Iran has lost numerous service members and civilians in terrorist attacks and conflicts against invading forces. Today, Iran owes its peace, security, and territorial integrity to the sacrifices made by these families' loved ones, making this meeting particularly meaningful.
But the timing of this meeting makes it even more significant, amplifying every word of the leader, with a huge crowd taking every opportunity to offer their support.
Just 2 days after the Israeli regime's military aggression, described by Ayatollah Khamenei as an evil act that must neither be magnified nor downplayed, many Iranians are calling for retaliation. Chants of allegiance resonate through the crowd as the leader draws attention to Israel's horrific war crimes committed in complete disregard for the UN Charter and the Geneva Conventions. Ayatollah Khamenei expressed disappointment over the international community's inaction against the Israeli regime and called for a diplomatic, economic, and even military coalition to oppose it. Most importantly, he emphasized that the Israeli regime must be made to recognize the strength, determination, and resourcefulness of the Iranian nation. Now, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, it is up to the responsible officials to take appropriate action. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
A chant heard in central London this Saturday as thousands from across the UK took to the streets in a counter-demonstration against right-wing extremism.
We've come down from Glasgow today to stand in solidarity with other trade unionists and anti-racists and anti-fascists against the mobilisation of the far right.
Not far from the counter-demonstrators, those who find immigrants the reason behind the socioeconomic woes of white working-class Britons are marching. Their detained leader, who goes by the alias Tommy Robinson, was behind the violent race riots this summer. Ahead of the march, he was arrested by the police upon his return from abroad under counter-terrorism legislation.
He is an Islamophobe and he is stirring up hatred, particularly towards Muslims, but also refugees. He's trying to build a far-right street movement behind him. And that movement supports Nigel Farage and Reform UK. So it's very a dangerous movement that could drag politics to the right.
Right-wing populism at the top. To those in politics, that's where the problem begins. Those failures include falling living standards and a housing and cost of living crisis, one of the issues that the far-right leaders claim to be addressing. The rise of the far-right is not limited to the UK, where right-wing Reform Party led by Nigel Farage won 5 seats in Parliament in the July election.
The threat of the far-right, campaigners say, looms large on British society. Lessons from the rest of Europe show a growing danger of disillusionment with politics and pandering to the racist agenda of the far right when it comes to immigration and also Islamophobia. The collective action today, they say, aimed at countering that. Saeed Poor is up, London.
The presidential election campaign in the United States is nearing its end, but with no lessening of warmongering rhetoric from both candidates. The outgoing administration of Joe Biden has effectively joined Israel's multiple wars and attempted genocide in Gaza. His party's candidate for president, Kamala Harris, and the Republican candidate, ex-President Donald Trump, have both seemingly tried to outdo each other in bellicose rhetoric towards Iran, Gaza, Lebanon, and elsewhere in the region.
Regardless of what the U.S. government says, be the administration Democrat or Republican, real peace is not at all in their interest. Because we have to always remember that the reason why the U.S. supports Israel is because Israel acts as an outpost of U.S. imperial interests in the Middle East. So the only reason why, in the case of the Biden administration, they pretend to want peace is just it's an acknowledgement of how strong the anti-imperialist movement has been and how strong the movement for Palestine has been in this country. But it's all political theater. It's all smoke and mirrors.
Amid record inflation, major dissatisfaction with both candidates, widespread fears of continued election-related violence and other issues, with Harris promising to continue Biden's policy towards Israel, many voters don't see any good choices when it comes to foreign policy in Southwest Asia either.
Trump, I get the impression, doesn't particularly really have an interest in involving himself in protracted wars. But on the other hand, I think he's perfectly willing to give the Israelis a free hand. I mean, a very free hand. Because, I mean, as bad as Biden has been, Trump will be far worse. I mean, he will give them carte blanche to do everything, anything and everything they want. And that would be really, really terrible.
The West has been stunned by the timidity and ineffectiveness of Israel's U.S.-aided missile attack on Iran. Many Americans say they aren't surprised by the attack.
I believe that we have been going after Iran for a very long time. Israel has as well. They've killed their scientists. They literally assassinated their scientists in Tehran. But we've also, the United States has had Iran in our crosshairs for decades. And I know that you probably read Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney's National Security Doctrine, that said Saudi Arabia is the gateway, Iraq is the stepping stone, and Iran is the ultimate prize. They have been trying to seize Iran ever since the Shah fell.
Unlike in 2008 or 2016, neither candidate is even suggesting that Washington break with its longtime policy of war over diplomacy. Promoting war in Southwest Asia may be the one policy area where the two main candidates differ the least. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets across Yemen, waving flags and holding banners to honor the martyred resistance leaders assassinated by Israel over the past year. They vowed to carry forward the legacy of the fallen leaders and pledged to deliver a historic defeat to Israel.
The resistance is unyielding. Each day it achieves new victories. Right now, coordination across the region is strengthening as factions work together to end the Israeli regime once and for all.
The protesters also lashed out at some Arab leaders, condemning their complicity with Israel against the Palestinians and Lebanese people.
Not only are some regimes failing to support Gaza, but some Arab rulers are aiding Israel. This is a tragic reality. By Allah, the Yemeni people will press on to liberate Al-Aqsa, no matter how long their aggression continues.
Despite repeated warnings from the U.S. and Israel urging Yemen to stay out of the war on Gaza, Yemen has continued to impose a blockade on all Israeli-linked ships sailing in the Red Sea. In a bold show of defiance, the Yemeni army has also launched hypersonic missiles targeting various military sites inside occupied Palestine. In response, both Israel and the U.S. have conducted attacks on Yemen, hoping to force Ansarullah movement to end their military support for Palestine. Their warnings and threats, however, have not deterred the Yemenis.
Israel threatens to attack us and target the Mujahideen in Yemen, but we tell them we have been through this before for 10 years straight. These threats won't stop us from supporting Lebanon and Gaza.
Today's nationwide demonstrations in Yemen reflect a rising call for action and solidarity throughout the Arab and Islamic world as people unite in support of Palestine and the armed resistance to halt what they see as a genocide unfolding against the Palestinians by Israel.
Yemen has already shown support for the people of Palestine and Lebanon by launching attacks on Israeli positions. The country now says 400,000 Yemeni troops are prepared for direct confrontation with Israel as the regime continues its aggression against innocent civilians. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
A massive march began in front of Al Husseini Mosque in downtown Amman after Friday prayers, with widespread participation. Protesters condemned the ongoing starvation and genocide in Gaza. They also denounced the recent siege and massacres in Jabalia north of the Strip. Protesters called on Amman to end all treaties with the regime.
It is time to end the Wadi Araba Treaty and cut all ties with Israel, starting with Wadi Araba and subsequent agreements, including the gas deal. Our demand today is clear. Terminate all agreements with the regime, especially in the light of recent Israeli threats against the region.
The march was organized by the Islamic Movement and the National Forum for Supporting Resistance and Protecting the Homeland. Protesters were gathered under the slogan, "Stop the Jabalia Genocide, Cancel the Wadi Araba Treaty."
The international community has demonstrated the failure of the international law. Israel does not respect the power of law, but only the law of power. There must be decisive intervention to halt these massacres, and all international institutions must act to compel this enemy to stop.
We are ashamed as tanks attack hospitals in Jabalia, killing patients and tormenting the wounded. Across Gaza, in Jabalia, Rafah, the north and south, and in Lebanon, homes are destroyed, and mosques and hospitals lie in ruins, with no one intervening to stop the Israeli atrocities.
Protesters demanded decisive action against the brutal crimes committed against civilians in Gaza, urging nations worldwide to take a strong and clear stance against these violations and to support the resilience of the resistance.
Protesters demand an end to Israeli atrocities and the cancellation of the Jordanian and Israeli peace treaty. Zayed Agarbe, Amman.
Limelight. From the bravery of Hezbollah in Lebanon to the courage of Islamic resistance in Iraq to the true Arabs of Syria to the ancient civilization of Yemen, resistance lives on in many different shades. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the second part. Press TV wrote, the first Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah, Sayed Abbas al-Mousavi, was martyred along with his wife and child by the same apartheid regime forces in 1992. A sad event, but it saw Sayed Hassan Nasrallah take the helm and ultimately drive out the occupation in the year 2000. The blood of Sayed Abbas al-Mousavi was the driving force behind that. Following the martyrdom of Sayed Hassan Nasrallah on September 27 this year, the Israeli occupation, its Western backers and some regional Arab supporters pontificated in the public domain the idea that Hezbollah was finished. Hezbollah was definitely hurt by pager explosions and assassinations of its leaders. But what is happening at the front lines now, and what has happened on the battlefield since then? Before directing his forces to invade southern Lebanon on October 1st, Netanyahu promised to return Israeli settlers to their homes in the north. Netanyahu himself no longer has a home thanks to a drone that flew undetected for at least 70 kilometers from Lebanon. There isn't a shred of evidence the Zionist regime can offer which will see the settlers return to the north, not for the foreseeable future. Hezbollah has at least 100,000 fighters, and only several hundred of them are defending southern Lebanon against an estimated 70,000 Israeli regime troops, many of them from special units. The Lebanese resistance is firing missiles across the occupied Palestine with chants of "At your service, O Nasrallah." It is safe to say that Syed Nasrallah's martyrdom has empowered Hezbollah fighters. And the long-range precision missiles, as well as other advanced military technology at Hezbollah's disposal, have yet to enter the battlefield. Yet, the Lebanese resistance is springing surprises every day. What had been expected from Hezbollah in any future war with the Zionist regime is currently being implemented with perfection. The Lebanese resistance has planned for every scenario. If a commander is martyred, another steps in. Everyone within the organization is battle-hardened, fully aware of their duties, even if communication is lost with the leadership. Each unit, missile, ground, air, and defense follow pre-planned combat guidelines to a T. The Zionist regime wasn't expecting the resistance to execute operations with the level of sophistication it is doing so after Syed Nasrallah's martyrdom. Drone and missile strikes from Lebanon have rendered the much-hyped Iron Dome and other air defense systems useless, striking the heart of Israeli regime military targets in occupied Palestine. Who would have thought a Hezbollah drone attack would strike the canteen building of the Golani Brigade base at the exact time Zionist troops were having dinner? Not 1 hour before, not 1 hour after. This indicates that Hezbollah has information on the most secretive Zionist targets that it can hit with precision, and it has now footage and data that its hot hop drone captured in the occupied land. Sensitive sites in Haifa are being bombarded. Only Hezbollah and God know that hot hop brought back from Haifa. The city may eventually turn out to be more important than Tel Aviv. This martyrdom of resistance leader isn't limited to Hamas and Hezbollah. There is Yemen as well, carrying out daring military operations against the Zionist entity and its Western backers without fear of consequences. Who would have thought that Syed Hussein al-Houthi's legacy of a struggle and fight against a long-term puppet leader of the United States would inspire the Yemeni revolution in early 2015? The poorest and war-ravaged country in West Asia region fought for its sovereignty and independence to stand up with Gaza and Lebanon. And the million-man pro-Palestine and pro-Lebanon marches across the country every single Friday for an entire year is what the mainstream media choose to conceal. When the Ansarullah leader Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi's wingman Saleh al-Samad was martyred by the Saudis and the United States in 2018, the Yemenis continued to fight with greater intensity. Mahdi al-Mahshat, who replaced al-Samad as the head of the Supreme Political Council, has made Yemen today a force to reckon with. How Zionist or Zionist-affiliated ships been able to transit the Red Sea? The answer is in Eilat port, which has gone bankrupt, as well as other Israeli-occupied ports. Vessels fear to sail in troubled waters. Attempts by the Zionists to send their vessels via the Mediterranean have seen Yemeni missiles reach them. This is while Yemen is firing hypersonic missiles at Tel Aviv in solidarity with Gaza. From the bravery of Hezbollah in Lebanon, to the courage of Islamic resistance in Iraq, to the true Arabs of Syria, to the ancient civilization of Yemen, resistance lives on in many different shades.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So, very beautiful discussion about Imam Ali alayhi salam, his universal persona, the things that we learn from his eminence's universal persona. And how amazing is it that over the passing of thousands of years, the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is still very relevant to the present day and to the matters of the present day. One of the things that is very beautiful that is witnessed in the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, is the fact that his eminence, you don't see any greed in his persona, right? You have a lot of global leaders, world leaders, you can see their greed, and you know, you can see it by their actions, by their past, you know, by their present, that these are just greedy individuals. You know, they're just in it for themselves. And it's very clear in many of the global leaders of the present day, you know, for example, the leader of Israel, or the leaders of the United States of America, or the leaders of the UK, France, the collective West in general, unfortunately, you will find that, yes, there is a tendency to see greed within these individuals. But when you look at Imam Ali alayhi salam, you look at his life, you look at his history, you look at his background, when you look at His Eminence's persona from beginning to end, you know, from the time where he was born in the Holy Kaaba, the house of God, up until the time where he was martyred in the Masjid of Kufa, in another house of God, right, the house of worship, the masjid, there was never any greed in His Eminence. You don't find Him amassing wealth. You don't find Him, you know, stealing wealth. You don't find him amassing property, or, you know, you don't find him taking more than he should from the public treasury, the Baytul Mal, for example. And so this is something that is very powerful. We, as an individual in the present day, you know, we have to be very careful, because greed is a very easily available thing that is happening all across the world, and it has always happened. We find many of the companions of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, unfortunately, were very greedy, and they amassed a lot of wealth of the Muslims. And so, of course, Imam Ali alayhi salam is this perfect example of an individual, you know, who is far away from greed. We too need to be very careful, you know, becoming greedy. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about it apart from his universal persona. He says that greed is a lasting, eternal kind of slavery. And so what a beautiful, you know, way to explain that. Greed is definitely something that gets one entangled. It's like a swamp, if you will, or quicksand, you know, where when you walk through it